It's my deep pleasure to welcome Sandra Lee Dennis back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. The occasion, of course, for her return is the publication of this new book, Love and the Mystery of Betrayal, Recovering Your Trust and Faith After Trauma, Deception, and Loss of Love. Sandra is a has delved deeply into a number of different spiritual traditions, including her time as a teacher in the Gurdjieff work, her time as an Ananda yoga instructor, her immersion in the Diamond Heart work of Almas, and her teaching work at the C.G. Jung Institute in San Francisco and other academic institutions. But the reason that I am looking forward to this evening so much is because I know that this is work that incorporates both the intellectual and the emotional. That is something that is important work for our time. This book addresses that. I will say no more, but be happy to invite you to join me in welcoming Sandra Lee Dennis to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Everybody, I haven't said hi to already. I feel so warmed by so many people I love showing up here tonight. Thank you for coming. last time I spoke here, I tried to ad-lib. Okay. But this time I actually tried to organize the talk, so we're going to see where we go with this. I might even read some of it. I'm going to read from the book quite a few things and give you a taste of the kind of writing that this book holds. I was thinking about how do I start this talk? You know, you're supposed to tell a story or tell a joke. I'm not a good joke teller. So I try to think of some jokes, but I canned that idea because I'm really not a good. I knew I would forget the punchline or something. So I like quotes. If you've seen this book, and many of you have, there's lots of quotes in it, and I really love quotes. So the quote that just came to me just a few minutes before coming over here was a Rumi quote, and it is, "Your task is not to seek for love, but merely to seek and find all the barriers within yourself that you have built against it." And that just kind of sums up what the book is about, I think. In my adult life, I guess if I was going to say what my deepest wish has been, it's been to learn what love is. And I especially got exercised around that in my relationships and, of course, with my daughter, who's here, Rachel. I felt so inadequate, like I didn't really know how to love her, which was a very terrible feeling. I mean, I tried, but I realized I couldn't really generate love. I didn't know how. I just didn't know how. And yet I did know that I could pay attention to the parts of myself that prevented me from loving. And that seems to have been my life path. I paid attention to a lot of things that have prevented me from loving. And this book certainly came out of a years-long experience of wrestling with obstacles that were so far from love that I couldn't even begin to imagine that was ever an interest of mine, because I was so wrapped up in various states of malice and, you know, revenge and plotting, you know, various stratagems for inflicting harm. I mean, it was pretty far from pretty far from love. So it's very it decimated my self-image and my sense of being a, you know, kind, wonderful, loving person. So, this book is, most of you here know, is a result of my falling into this hole, I guess I would call it, after my partner of 6 years left me abruptly just a few weeks before a big wedding that we had planned. It completely blindsided me. I know nobody ever believes that, but it was true. It blindsided me. And I was amazed at how it broke me down. It wasn't just for a few weeks or months. It turned into a years-long siege of trauma and PTSD, which I didn't know at the time. It took a long time to realize that's what happened. So this book is ultimately, it's a book about that journey from, you know, what they like to say, breakdown to breakthrough. I finally did have some breakthrough. It took a long time. I was so shocked that this seemingly minor event broke me down so much. I kept trying to figure out what is happening to me. And it drew me to my computer. I started writing, not really so much to write a book. I never was going to write another book. But more, writing sometimes serves as a catalyst for me, I feel like a channel that I'm getting downloading my help and support by writing. It comes through the words, and I would write, and I would get this guidance and support and these sort of loving voices coming through, and so I kept writing. It was helping me. And then after a while, I realized I needed to try to share what I was learning, so I started to think about it as writing in a way that other people could possibly benefit from what I went through. So I had to rewrite it like 8 times. There was so much rawness in it when I started out, and then so it's taken years. So most of you, many of you know this, but I'm going to share a little bit of read something from the book here about the state that I fell into. So I'm not in it now, so I can't speak from it now, but it's in the book. I mean, I'd lost relationships before. I'd ended relationships. My husband died, so I went through that kind of a loss. But this ending with this person was different. I say, when someone you have deeply loved and trusted cuts you off and shifts overnight from loving partner to contemptuous stranger, it is traumatic and terrifying. For a long time, I could not figure out why. Against my best efforts, images of his departure scene unnerved me day and night. I kept hearing his voice saturated with contempt. I am dissatisfied with you. I want a divorce. You are bad for my health. Being with you was a colossal mistake. I kept seeing his arms stretched along the back of the sofa, kept wincing at the memory of the slight smile on his face as he nonchalantly delivered the blow. Each replay threw my system into turmoil, like a nightmare that dogged me everywhere I went. In addition to the flashbacks, I dreamed and obsessed constantly about what had happened, variably crying and raging uncontrollably with no warning. I was on guard day and night. I lost 24 pounds within 4 months. To sleep was a nightmare in itself. Often I woke in a panic, as if there was a predator in the room. This seemed wildly irrational to me, and it was, but that did not mean the fear was not real. Each time I saw him around town, which was often, my chest constricted in pain and I panicked, freezing like a cliched deer in the headlights. It got so I hardly dared venture outside. I never knew when uncontrollable grief would strike. On those occasions when I did leave the house and the heartache hit, I would hurry back to my car or just stand in place clutching my chest, trying to be inconspicuous with what felt like a knife lodged in my heart. At times I worried I might be having a heart attack. I now understood how people could literally die of a broken heart. I consoled myself that these were natural reactions to abandonment and humiliation that would soon pass. Everybody said, just move on. But instead of improving with time, the panic, rage, and grief only continued to worsen. Primarily, I could not understand what was happening to me. All I wanted in this demented state of mind was for the torment to end.
and the most humiliating thing was happening. To my stunned, shattered heart, the only way possible for the pain to stop, unbelievably under the circumstances, was for Rob, what I call this person in the book, to return and end this nightmare. In such confusion and pain, I was desperate for safety and home, and he was that home. All my life I had disdained women who pined after men, especially men who had mistreated them so. I had imagined myself above what I judged as such pathetic behavior, but now here I was gone, way beyond pathetic. I finally had to admit to myself that I was in new territory internally. Far from certain that I could live through this and emerge intact, I still recall the moment, sitting in my living room, staring blankly at the maidenhair fern in the window, when it hit me. So this is what it's like to fall apart. So I was amazed after 5 decades on the planet that it was possible to experience this kind of pain. I was amazed. I had been a spiritual practitioner into inquiry and diving into my emotional states for decades, and I thought I was a resilient person. I'd been through a lot of trauma of various kinds, and like I said, lost my husband, many things. But this just amazed me. It amazed me that it was possible to feel the kind of pain and that it could be so protracted for so long. And there was no explanation for it. There was no reason. This is just a person who walked out. I mean, what is the big deal? This is my rational mind. and meanwhile, I'm falling apart. So I really became very, very curious about what was going on. And I turned to my spiritual practices immediately. I started sitting like 5 or 6 hours a day, just tracking what was going on, taking notes like a nurse with somebody in intensive care, like observing and noting and keeping track of how much I ate and how much I slept and where I was journeying inside myself. I mean, I did inquiry, I listened to Bach an hour a day for the first year. I read hundreds of books, I talked to scores of people, trying to understand, what is this? What is going on? Because it just didn't make any sense to me. And it's amazing to me, because I have a PhD in psychology, for one thing, psychology and religion, that I did not realize that I had been traumatized. I just didn't get it. It just never occurred to me. And of course, by the time it finally did occur to me, I was way deep into PTSD. And I got to find out what that feels like. Oh boy. So this book was written from those places. It's a book of inquiry. I'm sitting and I'm doing my best to describe what I'm observing. I like that quote from Hemingway. He said, it's easy to be a writer. All you have to do is sit down at your typewriter and bleed. And I thought, well, I don't consider myself a writer. I consider myself more a psychological explorer, something like that.
Did you say bleed?
Bleed. Hemingway. I'm not Hemingway, but when I was sitting and writing, I was writing often from the wounded place. And I think that was I read recently that Brené Brown's book, Daring Greatly. You know, the vulnerability thing is really popular now. I think that and that's one reason I feel pretty nervous sitting here talking, because it's such a vulnerable subject, and this material is so vulnerable. And I was writing from a very raw place. And yet that seems to be the very reason the book has been helpful to people. At least the feedback that I've gotten seems to indicate that some people think it's very helpful. So, yeah. Oh, look, here are my notes. So my mantra during this time was, the way out is through. I think I'm like a poster child for death psychology,
theory and mindfulness, because I mean I've been applying it for a long time, and I just think I'd like to say, think how bad it would be if I hadn't been doing that, because I'm not sure I believe in it, but it's been my path. I also exercise myself with concepts like the pain body. I thought, oh boy, this is a chance to heal it once and for all, because I'm observing it. And he said if you observed it for 2 years, it would go away. I just want you to know that's not true. No, it was at least 4 years, and it's not gone. Although it's much better, I think. Maybe it's just in dormant phase, you know, it can be dormant. So watch out when it comes back. Oh, and the law of attraction. Oh, yeah. We were trying to apply all that. I was trying to apply all that, too. Forgiveness. We're going to be forgiving. Yeah. I don't even want to talk about forgiveness right now. Really? Okay, so... all this made me realize that as a culture, we do not understand what goes on with a lot of emotional pain, and it's certainly not with what I'm calling betrayal and abandonment. So a good part of this book is devoted to talking about trauma and emotional trauma, and I say that the first order of business after betrayal is to recognize and to treat what is likely the most severe trauma of your life. We cannot take care of ourselves without a proper diagnosis. And that just seems to be one of the important things I think about having done this. That I have brought something into the light, I think, that hasn't been named so often for the deep devastation it causes. You know, betrayal trauma. We don't just call it betrayal now. Betrayal trauma. And again, from the notes, I've gotten lots of notes from people about this. Normally, we reserve the term trauma for what we believe are more severe life-threatening experiences than betrayal or abandonment. Those are minor losses, according to the culture anyway. Everyone will agree being dumped is humiliating, disappointing, enraging, and heartbreaking. Yes. We are expected, however, to pick ourselves up after a few weeks or months at the most, brush ourselves off, and get going again. Thankfully, in the past 20 years, with the help of neuroscience, MRIs, we are beginning to crack through the cultural denial of the emotional pain and psychological trauma that's involved in such a serious breach of trust. Human beings are delicate creatures. We become traumatized when we feel that our life is under threat, physically, psychologically, or both. The terror and helplessness overwhelm our survival instincts. Any situation, then, that violates our sense of safety and justice, any experience that we feel overcome by that leaves us helpless and powerless to go on as before, in short, any experience that makes us unable to bear reality, qualifies as a trauma. An injury to our psychological integrity can threaten and traumatize us as much, if not more, than damage to the physical body. Most often, an egregious betrayal is traumatizing. In many cases, it's emotionally violent. The life of your soul, if not your body, is at risk. Betrayal trauma is serious business. Very serious. Okay. So, I hesitated about using the word betrayal in the title, or I did more than hesitate. I agonized over it for a long time whether I used it or not. It's not, people don't like that word. In fact, when people ask me the title of the book around here, sometimes I just say, oh, it's about relationships. Because as soon as I say love and the mystery of betrayal, almost always I get like a double take, or eyes rolling, or the eyebrows lifting, because betrayal is, especially here, in our kind of new age environment, it's considered a sort of aggressive word. It implies that you were victimized. It blaming. It has a blaming quality. People, you know what I'm talking about. I had it in my own mind. I actually was John, who I just talked to recently, I thought an alternate title for this book would have been, and he mentioned it, and it was in my mind too. How can we stop hurting each other? And that question was in the back of my mind as I was writing the book. But because of the huge devastation that comes from the shattering of trust in a betrayal, I decided to keep the word, because it really describes something that happens that's different than it's distinct. I think it's a distinct experience. I have notes on that. Just a minute. I'm not exactly remembering. Here we are. Betrayal inflicts a unique, unprecedented pain you can only comprehend once you've experienced it. A lot of people would say to me, well, everybody's been through it. And I would think, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's a particular kind of violation of trust, a deep violation of intimate trust that shatters, that's identity shattering, and that takes us down in a way more minor betrayals don't. The type of betrayal I explore in this book is the one that breaks your heart, fractures your world, and threatens to destroy your soul. I found it described by people who've been through it as the most underrated trauma, the most difficult of all woundings, and more. So an interesting thing about the trauma that occurs and the emotional pain that they're finding out from the MRI studies is that emotional and physical pain both register in the same part of the brain. And the brain doesn't distinguish between emotional and physical pain. Mm-hmm. Which is such a relief to find that out, because you're sitting there thinking, I'm inventing this. I'm doing this to myself. I'm a 4 on the Enneagram. I love pain, and I'm inflicting it on myself. I mean, it's but I don't think I am. I'm really trying to observe it. I'm really trying to be detached and stand back. And I, like most people, was not previously aware that the brain does not differentiate between physical and emotional or psychic pain. With the help of the MRI studies, we now know that heartbreak and rejection do register in the brain as life-threatening dangers. A broken heart lights up the same brain centers as physical pain and produces similar sensations. In intimate betrayal, adds a complicating factor, however, to the broken heart of any attachment loss. In addition to the pain regions of the brain, rejection stimulates another area. This one is associated with addictive compulsions. Can you believe it? So important is attachment to our survival. Our neurophysiology generates a visceral craving for your former mate, along with a deep panicked fear. Thus, betrayal tosses you into a crossfire of love and fear, longing and rage. The disparate messages of these two brain centers whip up a biochemical torrent with their conflicting impulses and emotions, and throws the nervous system into pandemonium. So I came to the conclusion after some time that, and I wasn't the only one, because one of these neurological researchers said the same thing, that when we betray, and we all do it to some degree, but I hope this book helps raise awareness so that we do it less. It's like inflicting torture on another person. I mean, it's like being in a torture chamber inside your body. The pain, anybody who's been there knows what I'm talking about. It's unbelievable. It's like having an abscessed tooth in my chest for almost 2 years. It's just unbelievable pain. This particular researcher, her name's Jeanette Parrish, the psychic pain of mourning and heartbreak is truly unbearable with all the neurological evidence of a stress similar to being submitted to torture. I thought, well, maybe that's why Dante placed betrayers in the deepest ring of hell, below murderers. As one person commented to me, who wrote me a note, I hesitate to say betrayal is worse than death, yet there's a finality to death that separation cannot achieve. There's no closure with betrayal, however. It can eat away your joy and happiness so much. You live, but you want to die. So, this is where I started. I was chronicling this as I went along, and I was in very dark territory for a good part of this time, and it gradually changed. And again, it's chronicled. Some people get turned off by the beginning of the book because I'm like witness for the prosecution against this terrible person that did this awful thing to me who deserved to die. But that was the truth. I was interested in recording what was actually going on, and that is what was going on. In fact, let's see. Are we having fun with these quotes? This one's a little more interesting than those scientific things, I think, anyway. So after Rob left, I did all I could to manage the 24/7 anxiety. But when the rage hit, it obliterated any wise, benevolent self-images that remained standing. Although I had read that feelings of rage and murderous revenge fantasies are common reaction to traumatic abuse, I had no idea I was capable of such malevolence. Fantasies of tormenting and humiliating Rob came on at times like a flash flood. Maybe he would be in a disfiguring accident. Or be covered with warts or boils. Or catch some lingering, debilitating, sexually transmitted or become impotent, completely unable to perform sexually. That thought had great appeal. I wished for him to end up on the street, penniless. I thought of myself walking by, putting a few pennies in his cup. I even considered getting a voodoo doll and sticking pins in it if it could actually make him suffer half as much as I had. And if I ever heard reports of his good fortunes, my day was dark. I would seethe at the unfairness of it all. It was as if my civilized superego had gone entirely offline, and I was left to contend with my unabashed malevolence and animal instincts. If your conscious attitude has been one of tolerance, self-control, and forgiveness, like mine had been, and you suddenly find yourself filled with murderous impulses triggered by the smallest thing, the mention of a name, for instance, you can start to feel like a monster. Most of us do not like feeling like a monster. So the tendency is strong to talk oneself out of these thoughts and feelings, or to subvert them into distractions, addictions, illness, or more acceptable feelings. I could not help being ashamed of myself for entertaining such horrible imaginings and ill will. A little more. In calmer times, compulsive, more acceptable resentments preoccupied me, cataloging his defective character traits, blaming and condemning him in imaginary conversations, making my case against him before an invisible jury of his friends and family. The ongoing desire to hurt and devalue him as he had hurt and devalued me alarmed me, yet my broodings felt so gratifying compared with the bottomless pit of shame, pain, and loneliness that it was virtually impossible to stop them, despite my fervent intentions to do so. I learned that when we have been violated, revenge fantasies that mirror what was done to us, with the roles of trauma victim and perpetrator reversed, are a common reaction to the helplessness that you feel at your core. Instead of bringing relief, however, the fantasies only add to the inner torment, keeping you bound to the betrayer. You guys knew that already. Rage and vengeance fantasies defend against the powerlessness of being manipulated and deserted. We need to cut ourselves some slack at this survival-based reaction to trauma. Like a magic potion, rage and resentment serve as a kind of netting to protect us from the full impact of the shock. they have an amphetamine-like effect. Make you feel so good. That can be addictive and give a surge of energy, confidence, and power. I learned a lot about power over during this experience. I mean, it feels good. It is better than coffee. These reactions provide immediate relief for the battered psyche and hormonal surges to steady a tattered nervous system. So, trying to apply the new age ideas to this was not working for me. Like, we create our own reality, for instance. There are no victims. It isn't what happens to you, but your response that determines your experience. Really? Just forgive and you will be healed. Pain is necessary, but suffering is optional. I heard that a lot. Okay. Everything is for the best. Every one of these attitudes I found was completely toxic for me. It was to a traumatized person hearing any of that New Age stuff. It is like administering poison. It just adds a sense of guilt and inadequacy to the already like really heavy burden of pain and confusion that you're in. So this environment was not helpful. So one tends to isolate. when that's going on. Let's see. Okay. I'll just say this. I still find it kind of odd that we deny that emotion. Often we do deny that emotional violence exists. The whole idea that we could be victimized by another person is just so not popular. And yet it's true. I mean, if somebody runs you over with a car or stabs you with a knife, you are a victim of a crime. But if someone undermines your basic trust, deceives you, and there's a long line, list of emotional abuses that we do to each other, we imagine that the person on the receiving end of that should be able to just buck up and get over it. But what does it take to buck up and get over somebody running you over with a car or stabbing you with a knife? I mean, and in a way, these psychic, emotional, and mental violations are much more complicated. They take us much deeper. And I mean, there are huge possibilities, and I talk about that in the second half of the book, about what can grow out of this, what has grown out of it, at least somewhat for me. But people, there are people who fall by the wayside. I mean, I think a lot of people, I started to look around, you know how your radar changes, and I said, now I get what happened. People shut down. I mean, who's going to sit like me for 6 hours a day and suffer? seriously, my daughter had left home. I had just stopped working the year before. All I was doing was making plans for the wedding and shopping for a house and building my whole life around this relationship. And when it was gone, I didn't have any responsibilities. I mean, who has that? I have a pension, so I didn't have to worry about making money. So I'm sitting there. I have this amazing laboratory for studying this. And most people have a life, you know. have to live their life, even though something like this happens. And what do people do? They get addicted to something. They shut down, never have another relationship, or they turn into, you know, betrayers themselves. It just seemed like it's something to bring more light to. The emotional abuse is really devastating. It can ruin a person's life. But the thing that bothered me the most, I think, is something I call soul loss. It shuts down, the pain of the trauma shuts down your capacity to experience beauty, to feel joy, your faith is shattered. All the good things, all the reasons that you want to be alive, really, it's like your heart constricts and you look at the sky or you look at a flower and it's just dead, and that. That's a terrible thing to have happen to a person, and that's the kind of thing that can happen from interpersonal trauma.
anyway, okay, so I said that. Okay. So our culture doesn't give us much support if we're in a place like this. I got a lot of reviews, which have been so gratifying and really heartwarming to me. You know, really, like over 100 comments and reviews that have been, like, as I said, so positive and given me a sense of validation for having written this. However, a few weeks ago, I did finally receive the review that I have most feared. Of course, I have to read you that one review. The reason is because it's a good example of the cultural attitude generally toward emotional pain, and especially in a situation that looks so minor as somebody leaving you. I mean, let's get over it. So it was posted by a 25-year-old Australian who had won the book in a Goodreads giveaway. You offer the book and like hundreds of people sign up and one person wins. So that's perfect one. All right? And he wrote this review for me. No more giveaways. This book is not for the general public. I really didn't want to give this book a low rating, but quite simply, I was unable to finish reading it. Something about her writing and the stories she told were very hard to digest and get through. Mostly I found myself getting, I admit it, fed up with her sob stories. I wanted to reach through the pages of the book, grab her shoulders, and shake her. I wanted to tell her to just get over it, italics. This sounds awfully harsh, I know, and I feel bad for saying it. But every time she spoke about something that happened, whether real or imagined, I wanted to slap her and tell her to move on. Bold. It was reaching the point where I could only read a couple pages before I set the book down. I finally decided I couldn't slog through it anymore. I feel absolutely awful when I don't finish books I've won through Goodreads. But this book was making me really upset. This review was so close to what went on in my own head that I winced when I read it. I'm like, oh, there it is. I knew it. He sees the real me, you know. Sob stories. And, oh, God. Anyway, it's not extreme. This is an attitude that's kind of in the collective. And in my mind, it's pretty active. So in working on this, I was constantly having to deal with this kind of attitude in my own head. It was just unbelievable, really. Can we do that when I'm done? Keep it, though, because I'd like to know what you're asking. So that's what we're contending with, and that's the reason I think nobody talks about it. There's a lot of shame and humiliation that goes with this. You want to hide. You want to act like, I don't care. Like, I'm over it. Like, he's a jerk. Or she's a jerk, whatever. However it goes. And anyway, so yeah, that's why it's a vulnerable stuff, because there's this attitude. And I think partly, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. I think one of the reasons that this material is so touchy is because I think we all carry a very, very deep betrayal wound. It's an existential wound. It's a psychological wound. I mean, I'm not going to get into it. I'll talk about it in a minute. But I think we all carry it. And so it stirs up really deep feelings in us, these kinds of experiences. And when we see that pain in someone else, we don't want to feel that. It's way uncomfortable. So beyond uncomfortable, Winnicott called it primal agony. You know, there's primal agonies that we all carry, and
what happens in a serious betrayal with your trust undermined, it activates these primal agonies. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make everybody feel bad, but I think we all carry them. I mean, we're sitting there with them. They're deep in us, and as we go through crises in life, we touch into those places, and we're invited to learn how to hold those and how to learn to bring light and love and kindness and whatever else we can. We're invited to bring them to these really painful places, and this kind of experience, it opens up the door to these places that we keep very well hidden, and we don't want to get near. So somebody asked me, another friend, when I said, what am I going to talk about? I can't do this anymore. This is too painful. I don't want to go in there. It's exhausting, and read all this stuff. What should I talk about? And he said, well, what's the most meaningful thing to you right now about the book? And I said, well, the thing that has been the most important to me recently is getting these reviews, getting the feedback from people. And he said, well, it's validating. I said, it's not just validation. That's part of it. It's given me a sense of the book, the work the book is doing in the world, and it's also given me a sense of being able to trust something in myself. Because I wasn't sure when I was writing if it was true. I'm just a self-indulgent, you know, person who loves pain. But here's what I think I have something written here that kind of talks about my sense when I was writing, and a lot of times when I would touch into this deep suffering, I had a sense that it wasn't personal, that I was touching into something that was much deeper than my personal story. It was collective. It is a voice of many hurt and crying women and men and abandoned children. I would just be in these spaces where it felt as if I was going back in history, and I was hearing like a river, a stream of suffering voices, and not just my own. And I felt as if I was doing my best to translate that and to put that out on the page. That this experience is happening to me, but beyond me, it's a collective, it's a human experience. It's what partly why I say betrayal is an archetype, that it's collective, it's built in somehow to our nature. So anyway, getting these reviews back from people and comments from people made me sense that, wow, I got it. That was true. There was truth in this, because some of the things people were saying, this is exactly my experience. And that has meant more to me, I think, than anything else about the book. I've just so appreciated that circle being closed. So, and actually, touching into that collective field actually helped me make it through this. It says, I'm 5 years, this is the sixth year, and last year it started, I really felt like I started to lift, but 4 years I was really in a very difficult place. So for me, a life-serving presence quickened whenever I touched into the collective field of pain and realized how much suffering is impersonally woven into human nature. I came to know that whatever freedom came from my effort to welcome this bleakness as a holy part of life, it would spread into the collective stream. I intuited time and again that it would help lighten the burden for others. I do not know how I knew this. I just did, and it lifted my heart with purpose. Stopping to sense into this greater meaning in the mystery of suffering may help you too. From the heart of pain, we can hear the cries of the world. In your grief, you may want to try to look at others through the eyes of your pain. Just focus on your heart. It sounds counterintuitive, but looking about with a gentle focus on our personal injury, we can sense and even hear the cries of our sisters and brothers in the same distressing predicament. If you do, you may sense their gratitude for the attention you are bringing to the currents of hidden despair we all try to hide. also, I don't know if this is too self-congratulatory, but I wanted to read a few of these. I just arbitrarily categorized them into three groups of comments that I think underline what the book is offering, the kind of work it's doing in the world. And the first is that it's raising awareness, like I said, about this emotional trauma, emotional abuse, naming and diagnosing, like Leela said, like PTSD or ADHD wasn't named until fairly recently, and it makes a huge difference for people who are going through this to understand that it's normal. It's something that happens to anybody who goes through a certain kind of experience. So this person says, Sandra, you've broken the silence behind the trauma of betrayal. You're blowing the whistle on a society that minimizes emotional trauma because we're afraid of anything we cannot control, especially emotional pain. The book is vital because so many of us have been deeply traumatized by seemingly minor betrayals that have stolen essential parts of ourselves and haunted us for months, years, and for some, all our lives. Another, God bless you for spelling it out. I'm still reeling from a long-ago brutal abandonment. Betrayal is a very severe trauma, which has not received the attention it deserves, and truly, it can ruin your life. Another one, you'll highlight multiple statements for the sole purpose of quoting them when others don't understand why you're struggling so much. This book has the corner on the market on describing betrayal in a way that illuminates the deep horror of such harm. Another one, your book gives voice to the tragedy, the grief that no one recognizes, that paralyzes and traumatizes you, even if there's no infidelity or physical abuse. I know now that betrayers not only sever you from their lives as if you never existed, they sever you from the person you were, or more frighteningly, who you thought you were. Your foundational understanding of everything disintegrates. Naming this truth makes all the difference. Thank you, thank you. So that raising awareness, and the other that seemed really, and most, I'd say most of the comments seem to point to this. In fact, I wrote it down because I thought I'd never forget the first review I got like this, that gave validation, solace, and kinship. When you're in a space and you feel so isolated and the person is suffering and nobody sees it, you feel invisible, nobody gets it, it gets downplayed, trivialized, even ridiculed. It's so amazing. I mean, I read so many books before I found one, finally, where I thought I recognized the experience, and I just felt so grateful. Anyway, I got this letter, or this review, and after I read it, I just thought, mission accomplished. So she says, my best friend and husband of 18 years betrayed and abandoned me and my two children for another woman. He has no idea why I am upset. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I have ever written a review. I have a PhD in engineering, and I'm a tenured professor. Hence, I consider myself an intelligent woman. I never saw my husband's betrayal coming. The last 2 years have been absolute hell. My confidence has been shaken to its core. Everything I thought was real just exploded virtually instantaneously. Sandra, I've read many, many books on betrayal and infidelity, and yours stands out because you courageously spoke your story from the inside out. I'm buying more copies to give my family and friends so they can finally understand what I'm grappling with. For anyone coping or helping others with betrayal, this would be the first book I recommend people read. That was it. I was like, I'm done. I'm out of here. I think I'll die. that was a person I wrote the book for. I mean, then that was the first. And then there's been really many others. And just there's a sense of kinship that comes with recognizing someone who's gone through the same thing. I still weep over it every day. The book has been a balm on my heart. What a godsend the book has been. I kept wanting to shout, exactly, yes, because I so clearly identify with so much of what the author shared. It's a comfort to know I wasn't going crazy. Anyway, that's enough of that. I just devoured this book. The similarity of our stories was amazing. It was as if she was writing out my experience with her words. She hit the symptoms of absolute torment on the head without apology. I'm reading it again. I can't imagine that anyone could do that. The book is so... No, I'm telling you. I mean, to have to go back in here and try to find... It's like, who wrote this? It's intense. I it's exhausting to have to go in there. Oh, then this one. Dear Sandra, people should know your book is a book primarily about grief. Oh, you know, I think that's true. After the fact, I thought, it's about grief. I lost my son 9 years ago and have lived with a profound sense of betrayal by God. Your book describes my experience better than anything I have read, and your descriptions have helped me like nothing else to move through my feelings toward a loving acceptance. That surprised me. I think the last category, I think it provides a roadmap for the transformation of suffering. So the journey through this book is not just a compelling read, but a truly a healing experience in itself, medicine for the heart and soul. The book is unique and unusual. It deals directly with mental and emotional pain in depth. Most books shy away from the real experience and treat pain as if it will disappear once you see it and understand your issues. She shows how mental pain and anguish are a complex facet of human existence that need to be fully explored and processed. Oh gosh, this is getting to me too much. The introduction to this astounding book speaks of the dark night of the soul, a phrase that caught my attention and intrigued me. I didn't really understand what it meant until I was well into the heart of the book. It's hard to explain how deeply into the rabbit's hole this book goes, offering an illuminating roadmap that shows how much the transformation of suffering requires faith at just the time when faith has been shattered and stomped via the betrayal trauma. That is a dark night indeed. Given the near impossibility of the task of overcoming betrayal, hers is an inspiring and hopeful work that it can happen to you too. I never known pain to be described the way she has. She takes you into emotional and spiritual ride into the hidden dark parts of your own heart and soul, then brings light by languaging every emotion perfectly. Aren't I great reading you right? Okay, I can't do anymore. Except there's one from a therapist. I planned to skim this book for my clients, but was pulled into there's a lot from therapists actually, pulled into an incredible, compelling journey. It struck my heart and soul like a uncomfortably a terribly important knife. Sandra speaks to anyone who has experienced wounding and betrayal in any form. Partner infidelity, abandonment, rape, child abuse, emotional abuse, death or suicide, a loved one, any traumatic event. Okay. Okay, we're getting there. I'm almost done. And then we can have some conversation if you'd like. So, like I said, the comments kind of reinforced for me that betrayal is actually an archetype. A collective experience that's kind of embedded in the architecture of the psyche. I just arbitrarily think there's three levels of betrayal. It's the current day experience, interactions that we have, and we hurt each other, like the one I describe in the book. And then there's the psychological infantile layer that happens when we're born and in our childhood, and then there's an existential spiritual level of betrayal. And I'm going to read a little bit about those last two, not very much, but because we're getting tired here now. So infantile abandonment. Really? That's supposed to be page 155. Let's see that. So the heartbroken open in love opens like an archaeological dig into the past. The velocity of fracturing draws you down through layers of feelings, strategies, and beliefs that protect the heart from a primeval pain. Regardless of the quality of mothering we receive, abandonment happens to us all. This is why abandonment is archetypal. Being deserted takes us back to our origins and causes most everyone to panic and regress. This is an Italian analyst, Aldo Caro Tenuto, summed up the situation. We are all violently expelled from a paradisiacal, paradise, original condition, and our lives are spent in the attempt to heal the wound. To use another familiar image, the orphan lives in us all. The orphan is a metaphor for our primal experience of dependency and abandonment, of expectation and deprivation, and shame, loss, and loneliness. These long-buried early survival fears come to awareness and add their painful potency to our hunger for our lost mate. So that's the psychological infantile abandonment I think we all carry. And then there's the... is this fun? We also have existential abandonment. You want to hear about that? Okay. I kept a thin thread of awareness that my distress went beyond Rob's absence. I felt cut off, not only from him and from imagined warmth and safety of our partnership, but more important, I felt cut off from God, from the spiritual nourishment to which I was accustomed. I did my best to bring my heart into the infantile despair of no mother and the adult disheartenment of no partner. But beneath this dread, I found the spiritual ache of no God. This aching showed me ways my relationship had been helping me avoid feeling a profound existential emptiness. Many of our most horrible feelings, such as powerlessness, loneliness, and meaninglessness, stem from the sense that we are alone in the universe. Some traditions teach that all our suffering stems from this sense of isolation from God. The existential loss of faith in life itself is one of the worst torments of human nature that the betrayal of trust reveals. And here's a quote from Heidi Kolb, who's a Jungian analyst who I like. She says, "A deep-seated trauma most of us share is abandonment, being betrayed right from the start, being born into a world that is not welcoming, being born with a soul that remembers wholeness but cannot find it in lived life, a soul that is subjected to terrible suffering if she does not remember her way back to the source of her belonging. There's no escaping this most universal of themes. It comes with the equipment of our humanity. For life to have meaning, we must find the meaning of this betrayal, this earliest pain." Okay. I have one more short reading here. Maybe it's not so short, it's the ending. And then I'd love to hear from you guys if you have something to say. I kept trying to end this book, and I had a hard time. I just kept rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, and finally I was so fed up I just couldn't do it anymore. I just thought, I don't care. It's not done, but oh well, I'm done. So this is how I ended the book. I do not have all the answers I had hoped to find in my deep diving excursions. I did not have all the answers I had hoped to find in my deep diving excursions. I still do not know what love is. I expect to be living that question, learning the lessons of love until my last days. As Rilke says, it is also good to love, because love is difficult. For one human being to love another human being, that is perhaps the most difficult task that has been entrusted to us. The ultimate task, the final test and proof, the work for which all other work is merely preparation. I had not found a way to resolve all my difficulties, to flow carefree through life, or to resolve or reconcile my torn relationship. At times, I still wondered what it had all been for. This book, I realized, would be more a progress report than a summation. Yet I knew it was time to bring it to an end. In keeping with wanting to share my deepest truth, would I have to report to you that I must leave you with a fine mess? As the mystic teacher Gurdjieff is reported to have said when he died. Would I leave you with no answers, no solutions, just the same lot of questions and conundrums with which we started? Those were the concerns my mind brooded over that kept me for a long time from completing the writing. Finally, my heart had something to say on the subject. One day, in the middle of a visit by some inner demon, a simple reply came to the recurring questions that had haunted me during the darkest days. What does my heart want? Bubbling up from the quiet ache within, I heard a voice, saturated with authority, echo through me. To love God. And a radiant warmth filled me with sure knowing. The voice spoke the longing to love the divine in all things. It was the perfect answer, the last word, the motivating force for living. The longing itself, I recognized it as love. That I might better realize this longing as my lover and friend. That is what made me want to get up in the morning. At moments of connection like this, I wondered if drawing closer to communion with an invisible life that quickens and sustains us had perhaps been the purpose of the betrayal all along. I sighed again. A sigh of relief. Maybe it all did make sense.
Wow.
If a greater alignment with the heart's mystery, where we taste the love of the divine, requires that we plumb the depths of confusion and suffering, is not such a prize worth the cost? In those blessed moments, the answer is obvious. When love brings us home like this, and we recognize in an instant what we have been living for and who we are, we naturally forgive our mistakes and those of anyone who has hurt us. Most significant, we forgive the mystery, we forgive God, for creating this painful, messy life that we can never hope to truly understand, but are astonished to be learning to love and trust with all of us.
Okay.
Yay! Thank you, that was long.
So, if you have something to say, please do.
I was just going to say the analogy gave with the being run over by a car. One of the differences is that it's not usually personal. Yeah. It's usually an accident, whereas this was so personal, and it's another person, another human soul doing that to you, and that's really hard to answer to.
Yeah.
So, and then also with that feeling of, you know, betrayal and grief, other people don't know what to say. When someone loses a loved one to death, they don't know what to say. They avoid you, so then you get, you're alone more, because people want to, but they're not sure what to say, so they just decide, I'm not going to interact with that person because I don't want to make them feel worse. But they don't realize that's making them feel worse, that they're just really just sitting with someone is one of the biggest answers, giving them a hug and being there.
That's very insightful, I think. Right? Yeah, just sitting with somebody is so, human warmth makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that it was a trauma that, you know, that people don't realize that, because it's true. They gloss over emotions and don't realize you're grieving. It's very hard.
Yeah.
Cindy, I appreciated your saying, first of all, I really feel that you have done great service, and thank you so much for that. I wanted to say that when you said that the common cultural stereotype is that, oh, it's betrayal, everybody gets betrayed, and you said, no, I don't think so. And that's been, seems my observation. Some people, some souls seem to be hurt like this, and some not. And I wondered, just, that seems like kind of mysterious. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have anything to say about that?
Well.
I have, yes, I've thought about it a lot.
Yeah.
Why me? Or, you know, yeah. Why does it happen to some people and not others? And I mean, I read a lot about it. I do have a page or something on it in there. How
was it karma? Is it like, you know, sin? Is it, I mean, the long, long list, a cornucopia of explanations for why certain kinds of suffering come to some people and not to others.
Right.
And you know what I concluded? We do not know.
Yeah.
Really, we do not know. So, I do not know.
Yeah.
I still believe that what I said about human nature carrying a deep, label it what you want, but sense of separation, betrayal, a sense of hurt, that we are cut off almost all the time from the deepest meaning that our life can have, and we cut off, I speak for myself, most of the people I know, cut off from the sense of alive presence and love that when we're more awake and alert we know is there. And it hurts. It's almost always a feeling that there's something missing. If I really stop and ask myself at any given time, what's missing right now, I almost always can come up with an answer. But I think that that's touching that place, that something is missing, and that's the hole, that's the rabbit's hole.
Mm-hmm.
And if we go down that rabbit's hole, and some people get taken there by an obvious betrayal, and some people by getting run over by a car? I don't know. That's really the bottom. Actually, you know, that's my answer to everything now. I don't really know.
There's another piece that maybe you don't know either, but there's another piece that I'm very curious about, and that is that witness that was absolutely loyal, never betrayed you, and was with you from the get-go. I'm wondering if you can say something about that.
Well, that's nice of you to say. My witness was not absolutely loyal. It went away. I got lost.
Journey, you know?
That's true. You know, it's
and
a subjective sense, the subjective sense of it, of no God. The subjective sense. That's the dark night of the soul. Is it that John of the Cross? I mean, if you've ever read John of the Cross, there's a guy I was reading. He's like, he's describing my experience, but he's talking about no God. For me, it's like no Rob. Very low level. But the experiences, they're so intense. And that truly, I mean, he was like a stand-in, really, for this, what my being really is longing for. And it's an extremely trying time when we go through it, and what gave our life meaning and it makes us actually want to go on with life is taken away. Mm-hmm. I think we just take it for granted that all of us are feeling some reason for living right now, probably, unless somebody's really in deep despair. And in one of these dark night places, in the dark night place, it's not there anymore. I was telling somebody last night, I remember still lying on the couch in one of these pain periods, like, and just begging to have my illusions back. Please give me my illusions back. I really don't want to wake up. I don't care. I don't want to love. I don't want any of that anymore. I didn't realize that this was involved. I didn't realize this was part of it. And I meant it. I totally meant it. But it was like I was halfway down the slide and I couldn't get off the slide. I'm going down. I have to keep going. and during that time there was a sense of no witness, no presence, no, just lost. Just lost in the barren. There's lots of descriptions of it in here. If you want to have fun, you can read about isolation and the dark speck and the isolated cosmos and the bloody with no one anywhere near you.
You know
what I mean. So you know what I'm talking about. And you know, in my mind, rationally, I can say that, oh yeah, some presence never left me. And now, you know, when it's coming back, I can start to say that. But during the time, I couldn't, not honestly.
Just that you were able to write the book is proof that it was there.
Oh yeah, and it didn't. And I don't want to say like I channeled the book. I mean, I don't really mean that. But I, in a way, I mean, I'm at the point where I'm in my life, 10 to 12 hours a day for 3 or 4 years writing a book. I couldn't do that. I was compelled. I mean, I couldn't. I just cut everything else out of my life. I sat, and I would be amazed what would come pouring out. So I didn't. I felt like I was doing something. Like you said, it really did feel like a service. It was a healing for me, and also a service. So, excuse me. I was asking Kate, but then right then after.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I think everybody maybe gets it in different areas. Like some people have the karma in relationships. Some people have it in vocation, some people have it in family. I just, you know, got asked for my job, and it was the same. It was like something that I wanted so much. And just the feeling of, like, almost a wave of just being hit, of being tossed. And it's been much shorter, you know, and I would imagine not as intense, but it's also been very intense for me. And I just wondered, when you didn't really speak about it lifting, or when you kind of, you said 4 years. If you could, can you talk a little bit about when light began to reemerge, and do you have a sense about why, or was it just a matter of time, or was it the writing of the book?
It's also in there.
Is it in the book? Because I will have a look at the book.
It is in the book.
Okay.
This book ended just as I thought it was just turning the corner, so I talk about how that started to happen. I can't say There's no formula. What started to happen that I didn't talk about much here is I applied all these spiritual practices up the kazoo. And nothing worked. I was just more and more miserable, and nothing was working. And because I have that can-do personality, you know about that. I think I actually had to get to the place where I was really, like they say in the 12 steps, you know, you hit bottom. I'm not reading anymore, but there's a story in there of how I was so defeated, nothing was working, and I was in so much pain. And there's just a sense of giving up, like a deep surrender. I couldn't decide to surrender. Okay, I'm going to surrender now. No. It's almost as if I had to give everything to the part of me that felt like I could do it myself, that I can do this. I can wake up. I can heal my pain. I can pull myself together. I can observe. I can be a witness. I'll get it all straightened out here. Soon I'm going to just have it all together. I will observe the pain body. I will do the gratitude. I will work on forgiveness every day for 45 minutes. And finally, I'm just as miserable as ever. I still want to kill the person. And something just cracked. And it happened more than once. But I would have to be kept being brought back to that. And I'll say this also in my path, the mindfulness and psychological depth psychology approach, all of that has a big mental component, inquiry, observation, concentration. When you're traumatized, your neocortex goes offline. I had no concentration. I couldn't do it anymore. And what needed to happen for me in that brokenness was my heart, the longing, a devotional element started to come alive. And I started praying. In a way I never had before. It made no sense to me at all. It was complete. My rational mind is going, this is like stupid, blah, blah. But meanwhile, my heart is doing this activity. And that's what grew out of it for me, sort of a devotional surrender to something higher, like, I don't know what to do. I don't know, but I'm offering, I'm giving. That's what happened. And from that, it seemed like there was a light at the end of the tunnel start to come through. Yeah. John. Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry, this person. I don't know your name. No, you were next, because you had your hand.
Okay. It was more a question I had from your deep exploration. How would you say your trajectory is now in relating to yourself, and how you're able to live with a certain degree of faith in not knowing how things will turn out? Have you changed?
You just asked me that yesterday. I don't know. Those that know me, have I changed?
I want to know how you...
You know, it's very difficult to know that when you're inside your own self. Really, if I don't know, maybe if I ask anybody, have you changed in the last 5 years? Probably.
Or maybe change is the wrong word. Have you approached your work where some areas of your life might have just opened, or a softening, or a just like a holding,
mm-hmm.
There's a sort of a greater vessel to put it all in?
Well, you're just describing it perfectly. You're doing such a nice job. No, seriously, you are. It's something like that. I'd say that something like that. I think I'm a little shy about talking about this kind of thing. The reason being that the part of me that's like, so like, aren't I cool? It will take over the experience, and it'll become a part of my ego identity, when in fact it's more something that comes, it seems like it comes from a deep, more authentic
I guess I'll call heartful place, where there's, I put it this way, I feel more permeable to light, something like that, more often. And in that light is a kind of sweetness and a caring and a mystery. And sometimes more than, certainly more than before, rather than it being a mental construct, there's like a heartfelt sense of something just darling that is beyond my senses, that is with me. So, something like that. I wrote a great book on the trail. I don't know if you guys know this, but he's my guru in the department. I read his books and really appreciated his work, and he helped me with my book.
Okay. I appreciate, among other things, how you're trying to give a proper burial to some of these New Age platitudes. You create your own reality. These things kind of drive me crazy. They're half truths. There's some truth in some of these things, but it really misses a lot. And so I think the paradigm shift that I'm hoping is happening is a spirituality that has more emotional depth to it.
Yeah.
Because it's very shallow, kind of living in your head with these New Age beliefs, and it doesn't offer empathy to people. So I think a spirituality with more depth offers empathy for people. And all people need to do is just listen. Just listen, have your mind be quiet, just be there, be present, and just open your heart and be present for people that are suffering. Goes a long way.
Your new book talks about that too. What's the name of your book, John, again?
Flame. Dancing with Fire.
Dancing with Fire.
Veil Boat
Menu. Yes, Veil Boat Menu.
I guess I
want to
say...
Oh, the guy behind you, and then the shop.
Oh.
I don't know your name.
I'm Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. I feel closest to people in inquiry, when I find people who are asking the same questions that I'm asking. And the depth that I search for in the moment is a dynamic. It's a kind of a living conversation where I'm sorry, but there is no betrayal. It just does not exist. It does not. And it has to do with a deep belief that I hold that friendship is the greatest love there is. And you know that you've found a friend when you find someone who's asking the same questions that you're asking. And it turns into a growing conversation. And a real conversation, like to me, conversation is a great mystery. And so suddenly you're entering into this place of enchantment and mystery. And there's so much garbage in our paradigm and in what we think we're looking for in other human beings. And that garbage is going to surface and it's going to show itself. And things are going to break down, but it's all messages. Something is saying something to us all the time, and we're always being asked to listen better, to listen better, to listen better. And betrayal. And I really believe that in this paradigm here, consciousness is a post-traumatic stress disorder. Civilization is the same post-traumatic stress disorder, because it doesn't allow the kind of depth that is needed to move into that place where there is no betrayal.
Thank you. I like that. That's good.
Did I say that?
Yeah.
I think I said what I wanted.
Yeah. Appreciate that.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
sitting here tonight and hearing you, you know, read your book, I think the most meaningful thing in this moment is that Rachel's here. Like, I remember coming over your house and holding space for you and Rachel being there and thinking, what is this like for her to be hearing her mother raging and everything that you were going through for such a long time and move there and help you? And, like what is that healing? What is that to, like, many times we, you know, see our partners, our children go through pain, but to see your mother go through pain, like, and to get to have you see her in this moment go through that, there's something very profound of a completion and a gift to have you see her sitting here with so much light and make it through those darkest really years of difficult times. And so I just think, like, oh, what's that next sequel book of what it is you want to have? those that witness somebody going through that kind of betrayal, somebody showing up knowing that you couldn't do anything to really change what you had to go through. And so to sit here today hearing you be able to be light and laughing and how profound and seeing how much you touch people because of what you went through, and to have you here filming it and loving your mother is an incredible thing.
Thanks, Michelle. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you noted that. It's really true. She's been amazing. And it's changed our relationship, I think, don't you?
Yeah. I've learned a lot. Really learned to appreciate the process of... Everyone has their own unique process, and to be able to be a witness to such an intimate process, I just feel, I mean, it's a gift. It was so hard at times, but I feel like it set me up to be so much of a stronger person.
And know your mother from the inside out. Now, usually we don't, you know, we don't get to share our mother's inner turmoils and journeys, so to really know your mother from the inside out is an incredible gift.
She came back from Chicago to be with me.
Yeah,
I mean, I so tried to talk her out of it, but when I was on the phone with her in the early days, I was totally falling apart. I didn't tell her, but she picked it up. And you know what? She came back and lived with me then for 18 months, maybe. And it made such a difference in my nervous system to have her in the house and there. And she was so amazing. Really, she's a very wise child.
Woman.
Very intuitive. Yeah, she's not. I used to read that book to her, The Wise Child. So, anyway, thank you, sweetie.
Yeah. Thank you for the depth of work that and courage that it takes to bear one's deepest vulnerabilities in the face of this incredible mystery. It can be very disorienting. And yet finding our way back home is probably one of the most exquisite journeys that we can take. And when you mention how it is we do that in culture, and sometimes it's alienating and isolating, that we can and still express ourselves and welcoming each other into that shared goodness. We all have these vulnerable places within us, and yet we lack the courage, except for when it's exhibited on our behalf. It gives us encouragement to join together in a collective awakening to these mysteries. And I can't do this by myself. I don't think any of us can. So I'm really grateful that we have each other.
Me too. Me too. I feel it here.
For sharing your journey.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you, everybody, for coming and for being here. And these many people in this room supported me through this. And I feel so deeply blessed to have had the support.
Thank you.
And then here you are tonight. Thank you.
And thank you, Sandy. Yeah. And thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you. So many of you know the drill. We have a donation bowl over there, which we ask you to contribute to, which we share with our speakers to further their work, and also retain half to maintain this space for further such events. And I want to encourage you also to take a look at the book. I am sure that Sandy will be happy to both sign and converse with you, as she does with the signing process. And we'll look forward to seeing you again here at Many Rivers. Thanks again.
Thank you.